Chapter 5. Hippolyte, who had suddenly fallen asleep on the sofa towards the end of Lebediev's harangue, now as suddenly waked up, as though someone had poked him in the ribs. He started, sat up, looked round him, and turned pale. He seemed to gaze about him, as it were, in alarm. There was almost a look of horror on his face when he remembered everything and reflected.
"What? Are they going? Is it over? Is it all over? Has the sun risen?"
he kept asking in agitation, clutching Mushkin's hand.
"What's the time? For God's sake, what's the time? I've overslept myself. Have I been asleep long?"
he added, with an almost desperate air, as though he had missed something on which his whole fate at least depended. "You've been asleep 7 or 8 minutes," answered Yevgeny Pavlovich. Hippolyte looked greedily at him and reflected for some moments.
"Ah, that's all. Then I—"
and he drew a deep, eager breath, as though casting off some heavy weight. He realized at last that nothing was over, that it was not yet daybreak, that the guests had got up from the table only on account of supper, and that Lebediev's chatter was the only thing that was over. He smiled, and a hectic flush came out in two bright spots on his cheeks.
"And you've been counting the minutes while I was asleep, Yevgeny Pavlovich," he commented ironically. "You couldn't tear yourself away from me all the evening, I've seen that. Ah, Rogozhin. I was dreaming about him just now,"
he whispered to Mushkin, frowning, and nodding towards Rogozhin, who was sitting at the table.
"Ah, yes."
He flew off to another subject.
"Where's the orator? Where's Lebediev? Has he finished, then? What was he talking about? Is it true, Prince, that you said once that beauty would save the world?" "Gentlemen," he shouted loudly, addressing the whole company, "the prince asserts that beauty will save the world. But I assert that the reason he has such playful ideas is that he is in love. I was certain of it when he came in just now. Don't blush, Prince. It makes me sorry for you. What sort of beauty will save the world?" "Kolya told me. Are you a zealous Christian? Kolya says that you say you're a Christian yourself."
Mushkin looked at him attentively and made no answer.
"You don't answer. Perhaps you think I'm very fond of you,"
Hippolyte added suddenly, abruptly. "No, I don't think so. I know you don't like me."
"What, after yesterday? Was I honest with you yesterday?"
"I knew yesterday that you didn't like me."
"Is that because I envy you? You always thought that, and think so still, but why do I speak of that to you? I want some more champagne. Pour some out, Keller."
"You mustn't drink any more, Hippolyte. I won't let you." And Mushkin moved away the glass.
"You're right,"
he agreed immediately, as it were, dreamily.
"Maybe they'll say it doesn't matter a damn to me what they say. Does it? Does it? Let them say so afterwards, eh, Prince? What does it matter to any of us what happens afterwards? But I'm half asleep. What an awful dream I had. I've only just remembered it. I don't wish you such a dream, Prince, though perhaps I really don't like you. But why should one wish a man harm, even if one doesn't like him, eh? How is it I keep asking questions? I keep asking questions. Give me your hand. I'll press it warmly, like this. You hold out your hand to me, though, so you know that I shall shake hands sincerely. I won't drink any more, if you like. What time is it? But you needn't tell me. I know what time it is. The hour has come. Now is the very time. Why are they laying supper over there in the corner? This table is free, then? Good. Gentlemen, I—" But all these gentlemen are not listening. "I intend to read an essay, Prince. Supper, of course, is more interesting, but—"
And suddenly, quite unexpectedly, he pulled out of his breast pocket a large envelope, sealed with a large red seal. He laid it on the table before him. This unexpected action produced a sensation in the company, who were unprepared for it, and were by now far from sober. Yevgeny Pavlovich positively started up on his chair. Ganya moved quickly to the table. Rogozhin did the same, but with a sort of peevish vexation, as though he understood what was coming. Lebediev, who happened to be close by, came up with inquisitive eyes and stared at the envelope, trying to guess what it meant.
"What have you there?"
Mushkin asked uneasily.
"At the first peep of sunshine I shall go to rest, Prince. I've said so. On my honour you shall see!"
cried Ippolit.
"But do you imagine that I'm not capable of breaking open that envelope?"
he added, turning his eyes from one to another with a sort of challenge, and apparently addressing all without distinction. Mushkin noticed that he was trembling all over. "None of us imagine such a thing," Mushkin answered for all. "Then why should you suppose that anyone thinks so? And what a strange idea to read to us. What have you there, Ippolit?"
"What is it? What's happened to him now?"
they were asking on all hands. All the party came up, some of them still eating. The envelope with the red seal drew them all like a magnet.
"I wrote it yesterday myself, directly after I'd promised I would come to live with you, Prince. I was writing it all day yesterday, and all night, and finished it this morning. In the night, towards morning, I had a dream."
"Wouldn't it be better tomorrow?" Mushkin interposed timidly.
"Tomorrow there will be no more time," Ippolit laughed hysterically. "But don't be uneasy. I'll read it in 40 minutes, or, well, an hour, and see how interested they all are. They've all come up. They're all staring at my seal. And if I hadn't sealed the article up in an envelope, there'd have been no sensation. You see what mystery does. Shall I break the seal or not, gentlemen?"
he shouted, laughing his strange laugh and staring at them with glittering eyes.
"A secret! A secret! And do you remember, Prince, who proclaimed that there will be no more time? It was proclaimed by the great and mighty angel in the Apocalypse."
"Better not read it," Yevgeny Pavlovich cried suddenly, but with a look of uneasiness so unexpected in him that it struck many persons as strange.
"Don't read it," cried Mushkin too, laying his hand on the envelope. "Why read? It's time for supper now," observed someone.
"An article? A magazine article?" inquired another.
"Dull, perhaps," added a third.
"What's it all about?" inquired the rest.
But Mushkin's timid gesture seemed to have intimidated Ippolit himself.
"So I'm not to read it,"
he whispered to him, almost apprehensively, with a wry smile on his blue lips.
"Not to read it,"
he muttered, scanning his whole audience, all their eyes and faces, and, as it were, catching at them all again, with the same aggressive effusiveness.
"Are you afraid?"
He turned again to Mushkin.
"What of?"
asked the latter, his face changing more and more.
"Has anyone got a 20-kopeck piece?"
Ippolit leapt up from his chair, as though he'd been pulled up.
"Or a coin?"
"Here you are."
Lebediev gave it him at once. The idea occurred to him that the invalid had gone out of his mind.
"Hefira Lukianovna,"
Ippolit hurriedly begged her.
"Take it. Throw it on the table. Heads or tails?" "Heads, I read it."
Vera looked in alarm at the coin, at Ippolit, and then at her father, and awkwardly throwing back her head, as though she felt she ought not to look at the coin, she tossed it. It came up heads.
"I read it,"
whispered Ippolit, as though crushed by the decision of destiny. He could not have turned more pale if he had heard his death sentence.
"But,"
he started suddenly, after half a minute's silence.
"What? Can I really have tossed up?"
With the same appealing frankness, he scrutinized the whole circle.
"But you know, that's an amazing psychological fact,"
he cried suddenly, addressing Mushkin in genuine astonishment.
It's an incredible fact, Prince,"
he repeated, reviving and seeming to recover himself.
"You must make a note of this, Prince. Remember it, for I believe you are collecting facts relating to capital punishment. I've been told so. Oh, my God, what senseless absurdity."
He sat down on the sofa, put his elbows on the table, and clutched at his head.
"Why, it's positively shameful. But what the devil do I care if it is shameful?"
He raised his head almost at once.
"Gentlemen, gentlemen, I will break the seal of my envelope,"
he declared, with sudden determination.
I don't compel you to listen, though."
With hands trembling with excitement, he opened the envelope, took out several sheets of notepaper covered with small handwriting, put them before him, and began to arrange them.
"What is it? What's the matter? What's he going to read?"
some people muttered gloomily. Others were silent. But they all sat down and stared inquisitively. Perhaps they really did expect something unusual. Vera caught hold of her father's chair and was almost crying with fright. Collier was hardly less alarmed. Lebediev, who had already sat down, rose and moved the candles nearer to Ippolit to give him more light.
"Gentlemen, this... you'll see directly what it is,"
Ippolit added for some reason, and he suddenly began reading.
"An essential explanation. Motto, après moi, le déluge." "Phew, damn it!"
he cried out, as though he had been scolded.
"Can I seriously have written such a stupid motto? Listen, gentlemen, I assure you that all this is perhaps, after all, the most fearful nonsense. It's only some thoughts of mine. If you think there's anything mysterious about it, anything prohibited, in fact, if you'd only read it without a preface," interrupted Ganya.
"It's affectation," someone added. "There's too much talk," put in Rogojin, who had been silent till then.
Ippolit suddenly looked at him, and when their eyes met, Rogojin gave a bitter and morose grin and slowly pronounced a strange sentence.
"It's not the way to set about this business, lad. It's not the way."
No one, of course, knew what Rogojin meant, but his words made rather a strange impression on everyone. Everyone seemed to catch a passing glimpse of a common idea. On Ippolit, these words made a terrible impression. He trembled so much that Mushkin put out his arm to support him, and he would certainly have cried out, but that his voice failed him. For a whole minute he could not speak, and stared at Rogojin, breathing painfully. At last, gasping for breath with an immense effort, he articulated,
"So it was you. You. It was you."
"What was I? What about me?" answered Rogojin, amazed.
But Ippolit, firing up and suddenly seized almost with fury, shouted violently,
"You were in my room last week at night, past 1 o'clock, on the day I had been to you in the morning. You! Confess it was you!"
"Last week at night? Have you gone clean out of your senses, lad?"
The lad was silent again for a minute, putting his forefinger to his forehead and seeming to reflect. But there was a gleam of something sly, almost triumphant, in his pale smile that was still distorted by fear.
"It was you,"
he repeated, almost in a whisper, but with intense conviction.
"You came to me and sat in my room without speaking, on the chair by the window, for a whole hour, more, between 12 and 2 o'clock at night. Then afterwards, between 2 and 3, you got up and walked out. It was you. It was you. Why did you frighten me? Why did you come to torment me? I don't understand it, but it was you."
And there was a sudden flash of intense hatred in his eyes, though he was still trembling with fear.
"You shall know all about it directly, gentlemen. Listen.
Once more, and with desperate haste, he clutched at the sheets of paper. They had slipped and fallen apart. He attempted to put them together. They shook in his shaking hands. It was a long time before he could get them right.
"He's gone mad, or delirious," muttered Rogojin, almost inaudibly.
The reading began at last. At the beginning, for the first 5 minutes, the author of the unexpected article still gasped for breath and read jerkily and incoherently. But as he went on, his voice grew stronger and began to express the sense of what he was reading. But he was sometimes interrupted by a violent fit of coughing. Before he was halfway through the article, he was very hoarse. His feverish excitement, which grew greater and greater as he read, reached an intense pitch at last, and so did the painful impression on his audience. Here is the whole article.
"An essential explanation. Après moi, le déluge. The prince was here yesterday morning. Among other things, he persuaded me to move to his villa. I knew that he would insist upon this, and felt sure that he would blurt straight out that it would be easier to die among people and trees, as he expresses it. But today he did not say die, but said it will be easier to live, which comes to much the same thing, however, in my position. I asked him what he meant by his everlasting trees, and why he keeps pestering me with those trees, and learnt to my surprise that I had myself said on that evening that I'd come to Pavlovsk to look at the trees for the last time. When I told him I should die just the same, looking at trees or looking out of my window at brick walls, and that there was no need to make a fuss about a fortnight, he agreed at once. But the greenness and the fresh air will be sure, according to him, to produce a physical change in me, and my excitement and my dreams will be affected and perhaps relieved. I told him again, laughing, that he spoke like a materialist. He answered with his smile that he had always been a materialist. As he never tells a lie, that saying means something. He has a nice smile. I've examined him carefully now. I don't know whether I like him or not. I haven't time now to bother about it. The hatred I have felt for him for 5 months has begun to go off this last month, I must observe. Who knows? Maybe I came to Pavlovsk chiefly to see him. But why did I leave my room, then? A man condemned to death ought not to leave his corner. And if I had not now taken my final decision, but had intended to linger on till the last minute, nothing would have induced me to leave my room, and I should not have accepted his invitation to go to him, to die in Pavlovsk. I must make haste and finish this explanation before tomorrow, anyway, so I shan't have time to read it over and correct it. I shall read it over tomorrow, when I'm going to read it to the prince and two or three witnesses, whom I mean to find there. Since there will not be one word of falsehood in it, but everything is the simple truth, the last and solemn truth, I feel curious to know what impression it will make on myself, at the hour and minute when I shall read it over. I was wrong in writing, though, that it was the last and solemn truth. It's not worth telling lies for a fortnight, anyway, for it's not worthwhile living a fortnight. That's the best possible proof that I shall write nothing but the truth. N.B. Not to forget the thought, am I not mad at this minute, or rather these minutes? I was told positively that in the last stage, consumptives sometimes go out of their minds for a time. Must verify this tomorrow from the impression made on my audience. I must settle that question absolutely, or else I cannot act. I believe I've just written something awfully stupid, but as I said, I've no time to correct it. Besides, I've promised myself on purpose not to correct one line in this manuscript, even if I notice that I contradict myself every 5 lines. What I want to decide after the reading tomorrow is just whether the logical sequence of my ideas is correct, whether I notice my mistakes, and therefore whether all I have thought over in this room for the last 6 months is true or delirium. If I had had to leave my rooms 2 months ago and say goodbye to Meyer's Wall, I'm certain I should have been sorry. But now I feel nothing. Yet tomorrow I am leaving my room and the wall forever. So my conviction that a fortnight is not worth regretting or feeling anything about has mastered my whole nature and can dictate to my feelings. But is it true? Is it true that my nature is completely vanquished now? If somebody began torturing me now, I should certainly begin to scream, and I shouldn't say that it was not worthwhile screaming and feeling pain, because I only had a fortnight more to live. But is it true that I have only a fortnight left to live, not more? I told a lie that day at Pavlovsk. BN told me nothing, and never saw me. But a week ago they brought me a student called Kislyarov. By his convictions, he is a materialist, an atheist, and a nihilist. That's why I sent for him. I wanted a man to tell me the naked truth at last, without any softening or ado about it. And so he did. And not only readily and without any fuss, but with obvious satisfaction, which was going too far to my thinking. He blurted out that I had about a month left to live, perhaps a little more, if my circumstances were favourable, but I may die much sooner. In his opinion, I might die suddenly, for instance, tomorrow. There are such cases. Only the day before yesterday, in Kolumna, a young lady in consumption, whose condition was similar to mine, was just starting for the market to buy provisions when she suddenly felt ill, lay down on the sofa, uttered a sigh, and died. All this Kislyarov told me with a sort of jauntiness,
carelessly and unfeelingly, as though he were doing me an honour by it. That is, as though showing me that he takes me, too, for the same sort of utterly sceptical superior creature as himself, who, of course, cares nothing about dying. Anyway, the fact is authenticated. A month and no more. I'm quite sure he's not mistaken. I wondered very much how the prince guessed that I had bad dreams. He used those very words, that in Pavlovsk my excitement and dreams would change. And why dreams? He's either a doctor or exceptionally intelligent and able to see things. But that he is, after all is said and done, an idiot, there can be no doubt. Just before he came in, I had, as though purposely, a pretty dream, though, as a matter of fact, I have hundreds of dreams like that now. I fell asleep, I believe about an hour before he came in, and dreamt that I was in a room, but not my own. The room was larger and loftier than mine, better furnished and lighter. There was a wardrobe, a chest of drawers, a sofa, and my bed, which was big and broad and covered with a green silk quilted counterpane. But in the room I noticed an awful animal, a sort of monster. It was like a scorpion, but was not a scorpion. It was more disgusting, and much more horrible. And it seemed it was so, just because there was nothing like it in nature, and that it had come expressly to me, and that there seemed to be something mysterious in that. I examined it very carefully. It was brown, and was covered with shell, a crawling reptile 7 inches long, 2 fingers thick at the head, and tapering down to the tail, so that the point of the tail was only about the 1/6 of an inch thick. Almost 2 inches from the head, at an angle of 45 degrees to the body, grew 2 legs, one on each side, nearly 4 inches long, so that the whole creature was in the shape of a trident, if looked at from above. I couldn't make out the head, but I saw 2 whiskers, short and also brown, looking like 2 strong needles. There were 2 whiskers of the same sort at the end of the tail, and at the end of each of the legs, making 8 whiskers in all. The beast was running about the room very quickly, on its legs and its tail, and when it ran, the body and legs wriggled like little snakes, with extraordinary swiftness in spite of its shell, and that was very horrible to look at. I was awfully afraid it would sting me. I had been told it was poisonous. But what worried me most of all was the question who had sent it into my room, what they meant to do to me, and what was the secret of it. It hid under the chest of drawers, under the cupboard, crawled into corners. I sat on a chair and drew my legs up under me. It ran quickly right across the room and disappeared near my chair. I looked about in terror, but as I sat with my legs curled up, I hoped that it would not crawl up the chair. Suddenly, I heard behind me, almost at my head, a sort of scraping rustle. I looked round and saw that the reptile was crawling up the wall, and was already on a level with my head, and was positively touching my hair with its tail, which was twirling and wriggling with extraordinary rapidity. I sprang up, and the creature disappeared. I was afraid to lie down on the bed for fear it should creep under the pillow. My mother came into the room with some friend of hers. They began trying to catch the creature, but were cooler than I was and were not, in fact, afraid of it. But they didn't understand. Suddenly the reptile crawled out again. It seemed to have some special design, and crawled this time very slowly across the room towards the door, wriggling slowly, which was more revolting than ever. Then my mother opened the door and called Norma, our dog, a huge, shaggy, black Newfoundland. It died 5 years ago. It rushed into the room and stopped short before the reptile. The creature stopped too, but still wriggled and scraped the ground with its paws and tail. Animals cannot feel terror of the mysterious, unless I'm mistaken. But at that moment it seemed to me that there was something very extraordinary in Norma's terror, as though there was something uncanny in it, as though the dog too felt that there was something ominous, some mystery in it. She moved back slowly, facing the reptile, which crept slowly and cautiously towards her. It seemed meaning to dart at her and sting her. But in spite of her fear, Norma looked very fierce, though she was trembling all over. All at once she slowly bared her terrible teeth and opened her huge red jaws, crouched, prepared for a spring, made up her mind, and suddenly seized the creature with her teeth. The reptile must have struggled to slip away, so that Norma caught it once more as it was escaping, and twice over got it full in her jaws, seeming to gobble it up as it ran. Its shell cracked between her teeth. The tail and legs hanging out of the mouth moved at a tremendous rate. All at once Norma gave a piteous squeal. The reptile had managed to sting her tongue. Whining and yelping, she opened her mouth from the pain, and I saw that the creature, though bitten in two, was still wriggling in her mouth, and was emitting from its crushed body, onto the dog's tongue, a quantity of white fluid, such as comes out of a squashed black beetle. Then I waked up, and the prince came in. "Gentlemen," said Ippolit, suddenly breaking off from his reading, and seeming almost ashamed.
"I haven't read this over, but I believe I have really written a great deal that's superfluous. That dream..."
"That's true enough," Ganya hastened to put in.
"There's too much that's personal in it, I must own. That is, about myself."
As he said this, Ippolit had a weary and exhausted air, and wiped the sweat off his forehead with his handkerchief.
"Yes, you're too much interested in yourself," hissed Lebedev.
"I don't force anyone, let me say again, gentlemen. If anyone doesn't want to hear, he can go away."
"He turns them out of another man's house," Rogojin grumbled, hardly audibly. "And now if we all get up and go away," said Ferdoshenko suddenly.
He had till then not ventured to speak aloud. Ippolit dropped his eyes suddenly and clutched his manuscript, but at the same second he raised his head again, and with flashing eyes and two patches of red on his cheeks, he said, looking fixedly at Ferdoshenko,
"You don't like me at all."
There was laughter. Most of the party did not laugh, however. Ippolit flushed horribly. "Ippolit," said Mushkin, "fold up your manuscript and give it to me, and go to bed here in my room. We'll talk before you go to sleep, and tomorrow, but on condition that you never open these pages. Will you?"
"Is that possible?"
Ippolit looked at him in positive amazement. "Gentlemen," he cried, growing feverishly excited again,
"this is a stupid episode in which I haven't known how to behave. I won't interrupt the reading again. If anyone wants to listen, let him."
He took a hurried gulp of water from the glass, hurriedly put his elbows on the table to shield his face from their eyes, and went on, obstinately reading. But his shame soon passed off.
"The idea," he went on, "that it's not worthwhile to live a few weeks began to come over me, really, I fancy, a month ago, when I had 4 weeks to live. But it only took complete possession of me 3 days ago, when I came back from that evening at Pavlovsk. The first moment that I fully directly grasped that thought was on the prince's veranda, at the instant when I was meaning to make a last trial of my life, when I wanted to see people and trees. Granted, I said that myself. When I got excited, insisted on the rights of Berdovsky, my neighbour, and dreamed that they would all fling wide their arms and clasp me in them, and beg my forgiveness for something, and I theirs. In short, I behaved like a stupid fool. And it was at that time that a last conviction sprang up in me. I wondered how I could have lived for 6 months without that conviction. I knew for a fact that I had consumption, and it was incurable. I didn't deceive myself, and understood the case clearly. But the more clearly I understood it, the more feverishly I longed to live. I clutched at life. I wanted to live, whatever happened. Admitting that I might well have resented the dark and obscure lot which was to crush me like a fly, and of course with no reason, yet why couldn't I have stopped at resentment? Why did I actually begin living, knowing that I couldn't begin it now? Why did I try it, knowing that it was useless for me to try anything? And yet I could not even read, and gave up books. What use to read? What use to learn for 6 months? More than once that thought drove me to fling aside a book. Yes, that wall of Myers could tell a story. I've written a great deal on it. There isn't a spot on that filthy wall which I haven't studied. Cursed wall! And yet it's dearer to me than all the streets of Pavlovsk. That is, it would be dearer than all, if everything were not all the same to me now. I remember now with what greedy interest I began at that time, watching their life. I had had no such interest in the past. I used to look forward with cursing and impatience to seeing Kolya, when I was too ill to go out myself. I pried into every detail, and was so interested in every rumour that I believe I became a regular gossip. I couldn't understand, for instance, why people who had so much life before them did not become rich, and indeed I don't understand it now. I knew one poor fellow who, I was told afterwards, died of hunger, and I remember that it made me furious. If it had been possible to bring the poor devil back to life, I believe I'd have had him executed. I was sometimes better for weeks at a time and able to go out of doors, but the street exasperated me at last to such a degree that I purposely sat indoors for days together, though I could have gone out like anyone else. I couldn't endure the scurrying, bustling people, everlastingly dreary, worried and preoccupied, flitting to and fro about me on the pavement. Why their everlasting gloom, uneasiness and bustle, their everlasting sullen spite, for they are spiteful, spiteful, spiteful. Whose fault is it that they are miserable and don't know how to live, though they've 60 years of life before them? Why did Zanitsyn let himself die of hunger when he had 60 years of life before him? And each one points to his rags, his toil-worn hands, and cries savagely, "We toil like cattle! We labour, we are poor and hungry as dogs! Others don't toil and don't labour, and they are rich!" The everlasting story. Among them, running and struggling from morning to night, is some miserable sniveller, like Ivan Fomitch Surikov, a gentleman born. He lives in our block over my head, always out at elbows, with his buttons dropping off, running errands and taking messages for all sorts of people from morning till night. Talk to him. He's poor, destitute, starving. His wife died. He couldn't buy medicine for her. His baby was frozen to death in the winter. His elder daughter is a kept mistress. He's forever whimpering and complaining. Oh, I've never felt the least pity for these fools. And I don't now. I say so with pride. Why isn't he a Rothschild? Whose fault is it that he hasn't millions like Rothschild, that he hasn't a heap of golden imperials and Napoleon d'Or, a perfect mountain as high as the mounds made in Carnival Week? If he's alive, he has everything in his power. Whose fault is it he doesn't understand that? Oh, now I don't care. Now I've no time to be angry, but then... then, I repeat, I literally gnawed my pillow at night and tore my quilt with rage. Oh, how I used to dream then. How I longed to be turned out into the street at 18, almost without clothing, almost without covering, to be deserted and utterly alone, without lodging, without work, without a crust of bread, without relations, without one friend in a great town, hungry, beaten so much the better, but healthy. And then I would show them. What would I show? Oh, no doubt you think I don't know how I've humiliated myself as it is by my explanation. Oh, everyone, of course, will look upon me as a sniveller who knows nothing of life, forgetting that I'm not 18 now, forgetting that to live as I have lived for these 6 months means as much as living to grey old age. But let them laugh and say that this is all fairy tales. It's true. I've told myself fairy tales. I have filled whole nights in succession with them. I remember them all now. But is it for me to tell them now? Now, when the time for fairy tales is over, even for me? And to whom? I amused myself with them when I saw clearly that I was forbidden even to learn the Greek grammar, as I once thought of doing. I shall die before I get to the syntax, I thought at the first page, and threw the book under the table. It's lying there still. I've forbidden Matryona to pick it up. Anyone into whose hands my explanation falls, and who has the patience to read it through, may look upon me as a madman, or as a schoolboy, or more likely still as a man condemned to death, for whom it's natural to believe that everyone else thinks too little of life, and is apt to waste it too cheaply, and to use it too lazily, too shamelessly, that they're none, not one of them worthy of it. Well, I protest that my reader will be mistaken,
and that my conviction has nothing to do with my being sentenced to death. Ask them. Ask them what they all, every one of them, understand by happiness. Oh, you may be sure that Columbus was happy, not when he had discovered America, but when he was discovering it. Take my word for it. The highest moment of his happiness was just 3 days before the discovery of the New World, when the mutinous crew were on the point of returning to Europe in despair. It wasn't the New World that mattered, even if it had fallen to pieces. Columbus died almost without seeing it, and not really knowing what he had discovered. It's life that matters. Nothing but life. The process of discovering, the everlasting and perpetual process. Not the discovery itself at all. But what's the use of talking? I suspect that all I'm saying now is so like the usual commonplaces that I shall certainly be taken for a lower-form schoolboy, sending in his essay on sunrise. Or they'll say perhaps that I had something to say, but that I did not know how to explain it. But I'll add, though, that there is something at the bottom of every new human thought, every thought of genius, or even every earnest thought that springs up in any brain, which can never be communicated to others, even if one were to write volumes about it and were explaining one's idea for 35 years. There's something left which cannot be induced to emerge from your brain, and remains with you forever, and with it you will die, without communicating to anyone perhaps the most important of your ideas. But if I too have failed to convey all that has been tormenting me for the last 6 months, it will anyway be understood that I have paid very dearly for attaining my present last conviction. That is what I felt necessary for certain objects of my own to put forward in my explanation. However, I will continue.